So this year, I am offering a once a month a study program, practice program on what's called the paramis, the perfections. And these are qualities, some people might call them virtues, but qualities of the heart, qualities that are cultivated, can be cultivated, which are support for the path to liberation, and which are an expression of the maturity of people who are developing and maturing in the path to liberation. They're often overlooked by meditators, especially sometimes here in the West, where sometimes people think, well, meditation's all I need to do. Sometimes in our tradition, people do a lot of retreats and go sit and sit and sit. And they're focused a lot on the power of mindfulness, on presence, on concentration, on meditation, and overlook developing other qualities. And that works pretty well for some people, but it's often, sometimes it adds, it lends itself to problems. It sometimes makes a kind of dualistic kind of approach to a spiritual life, where one part of our life is okay to address and develop and other parts are not. It also leads to kind of being an imbalanced spiritual life sometimes, where people can be very, very well developed in one area of their life, but not in others. Or there can be areas of their life which people don't actually notice or pay attention to. They have blinders on, they're unconscious for. And mindfulness by itself doesn't guarantee for everybody that all the areas of our inner life, our spiritual life, are somehow addressed and dealt with in the course of meditation practice or mindfulness practice. And so these developing these other qualities and looking how they exist within us is one of the ways of ensuring that we kind of develop ourselves in a well-rounded way, and we have the necessary or the appropriate supports for going really deep in practice. Sometimes people will go quite deep in practice but not have that support, and sometimes it gets kind of difficult for people because they feel kind of very kind of wobbly or uncertain, or it can be quite transforming, you know, the whole movement towards liberation. And unless there's a firm basis of context to hold that, some people get frightened, some people get, all kinds of things can happen. So the paramis, again, are also one of these ways of developing this broad support so that the deep work of transformation has a base. So what I wanted to do is, on the Monday following the Friday study class, we'd look at one of these qualities to give a talk on this quality. It happens to be that last Friday was the day to look at ethics or virtue. And so we spent time looking at it and discussing it last week. And it also coincides with a lot of discussion nationally about the role of morality in the United States. It's become like one of the number one topics, or number two or something, moral values. And not only moral values, but moral values in a religious setting, in a religious context. What do the religious people have to say about ethics and values and other people's values? So what does Buddhism have to say about this? Well, ethics, or cultivating an ethical sensibility inside of us, ethics has to do with some of the most interesting aspects of human life. It has to do with things like, you know, people write books and movies and soap operas about things having to do with ethics, right? Sex, money, power, relationships. You know, what else is there? pleasure. So certainly something that, you know, captivates people's interest in all kinds of other settings. Sometimes people come to a Buddhist context, a meditation context, they don't want to hear about ethics. But then they go home and turn on the television or read the newspaper, and it's, you know, all over. There are a lot of ethical issues. These ethical issues are connected to some of the deepest longings, deepest aspirations, deepest core aspects of a human being. And so to look at ethics, to look at ethical sensibility, is to hopefully connect with something that's very deep in each individual person. And one of the issues in any kind of life, I would believe, but certainly in a spiritual life, where it becomes essential, is to somehow to harmonize our core inner values, core inner sensibilities, with our behavior and how we live. And without correlating those two together, I would say there is no spiritual life at all. We're fooling ourselves if we don't kind of harmonize those, you know, our inner life and our outer actions. And how we act based on our inner values has to do with ethics. That's what ethics is all about. My first interest in Buddhist practice, it was a little bit more, I would say, compared to later interests, was a little more intellectual. But it got me into studying Buddhism and getting interested in it. It was when I was a college student, and I was 18 years old, living in the dorms in college. And it was during the Vietnam War, and I could be drafted. And so there was a lot of discussion among the other 18-year-olds, especially the guys, about the war in Vietnam and what was going to happen if we got drafted. And I was the extreme pacifist on our dorm floor. So when you're extreme on one side, then you have to be, you know, you have to, there was a lot of discussions, you know, kind of intense discussions. But one of the things I was very clear about was that my dedication to nonviolence wasn't passive in the sense of, you know, just letting whatever happens is fine, I'm not going to, you know, get involved. But I felt that a nonviolent approach to dealing with conflict in society and the world would require me someday to put myself in a situation where I put my life on the line. And there were examples back then of certainly college students getting killed in America because of their protests against the war. And there was a fair amount of violence in this country because people were protesting a war someplace else. And I felt, like, well, you know what, I have to, you know, I might come to a day where I have to kind of stand in a protest line or do something that threatened my life. And if I was going to be committed to nonviolent action, I'd have to be able to risk my life for that purpose. But what I noticed was that I didn't seem to have the ability to do that, that I was afraid. And that incongruence between what I felt was the right thing to do and what my values were and my inability to follow through on it bothered me a lot. And I felt like I needed to find some way to deal with my fear so that I could follow, you know, live my values. And that's where Buddhism came in. And for some reason that I can't exactly point to you why, I hooked on to the idea that Buddhism offered me a practice in a way to somehow help me deal and resolve with the fear that would prevent me from doing what I feel was aligned with my deepest values. One of the interesting questions is why people don't live by their deepest values. And that assumes people know their deepest values. It's very easy to live by superficial values. And I think that a lot of people haven't really explored the depth of their beliefs, the depth of their values, the depth of their hearts, the depth of their sensibilities to others, in such a way that this becomes a relevant issue. But if we have some sense of ethical depth within us, then there are things like fear, or ambition, or hatred, or confusion, many things that can get in the way from really following through and living based on those values. And then it's part of the function of a spiritual practice, I believe, is to be able to look at these fear, the hate, the greed, and things that gets in the way of living from this deepest place that we know. Now, what I'm calling the ethical sensibility or the ethical integrity or the depth within us is something I think that's not so far away from most people. I don't think it's so foreign. Sometimes people say, you know, that they, you know, anyway, it's not so foreign. And one of the ways to get a sense of this is to spend 5 minutes with a total stranger, but really sitting down in front of the total stranger and really sitting and looking at them, really looking at them, even in silence. And sometimes in workshop kind of situations, people do this kind of exercise where you sit down with a total stranger and you sit there and you look at them. And maybe the workshop leader talks about, you know, this person's a person like you, and the person was born, this person had parents, and this person went through the trials and tribulations of growing up, and this person, like you, has probably known some death in their life, that people have died that were important for them. They've probably gone through various struggles, like everybody else does, and kind of go through kind of the universal aspects of what human life is like. Just talk about it, and you're sitting looking at this person, and taking them in, they're taking you in. And after 5 minutes of doing this, I've known people then who feel more connected to that person than people they spend an hour talking to. A kind of depth, they're really taking someone and really letting them in to our psyche, into our heart, really taking with this person. And if you take a person in with that kind of presence, it's going to be very hard to lie to them or steal from them or act somehow unethically towards them, because there's kind of a depth of connection that's there. So that depth of connection, I would argue, is not so far away if we give ourselves a chance to really take in other people or take in the situation from a very deep sense of careful presence and sensitivity. Mindfulness itself, the practice that we do here at IMC, is a practice of becoming more sensitive and learning how to be skillful and wise in developing a heightened sensitivity. And if you want to develop a heightened sensitivity, you don't want to do insensitive things. And the idea is that being unethical is based on being insensitive. So if the movement is to become more sensitive, don't disrupt that movement by doing insensitive things. It just doesn't make sense to do that. So to kind of drop into some depth of ethical integrity, some sense of, some people would call it authenticity, some people would call it integrity. Some people might call it beauty, heartfeltness, is one of the, I think, one of the most beautiful things a human being can do. And for me, personally, ethical purity is something I really find beautiful in people. And I'm actually more interested in finding ethical purity in people or ethical maturity in people than I am in spiritual maturity, if we can see the two as being separate. And some people have this kind of approach, you know, enlightenment or bust. And it might be nice. But ethical or bust, how about that? I'm going to get really ethical or, you know. In the Buddhist tradition, it's understood that the ethical place of ethical sensitivity inside of us is a very beautiful place. There's all these praises, wonderful praises to its value and its importance. And I want to read you one passage which talks about virtue, one of these perfections, ethical sensitivity, integrity, in the following way. The perfection of virtue should be thought about as follows. Even the waters of the Ganges cannot wash away the stain of hatred, yet the water of virtue is able to do so. Even yellow sandalwood cannot cool the fever of lust, yet virtue is able to remove it. Virtue is the unique adornment of good people, surpassing the adornments cherished by average folk, such as necklaces and earrings. So the idea that your virtue, your ethical depth, is an adornment, is a sort of an ornament, something makes you really beautiful. And it's said in the Buddhist tradition that you need to have some of this adornment in order to follow the path to enlightenment, to go all the way. Isn't that nice? You have to make yourself beautiful first. Virtue should be reflected upon as the basis for rapture and joy, as granting immunity from fear of self-reproach or the reproach of others. It should be thought about as offering freedom from punishment, It is praised by the wise, it is the root cause of freedom from remorse, and it is the basis for safety. Virtue surpasses material wealth because thieves cannot confiscate it, because it enables one to achieve supreme sovereignty over one's own mind. Virtue surpasses the sovereignty of warriors, kings, and priests. Isn't that great? If you want a lot of power, then the highest power is control over your own mind. Virtue surpasses the achievement of beauty, for it makes one beautiful even to one's enemies. It cannot be vanquished by the adversities of aging and sickness. Since it is the foundation for states of happiness, virtue surpasses such dwellings as palaces and mansions. In accomplishing the difficult task of self-protection, virtue is superior to troops of elephants, horses, chariots, and infantry. So those of you who have elephants, they're not going to do you much good. As well as such devices as mantras, spells, and blessings. For it depends on oneself, not on others. Thus, esteeming virtue as the foundation of all achievements, as the soil for the origination of all the Buddha qualities, the beginning, footing, head, and chief of all the qualities issuing in Buddhahood, one should guard diligently and thoroughly perfect virtue as a hen guards its eggs. That was kind of anticlimactic to have that as an example. Except the idea of, you know, of a chicken sitting there kind of nurturing and keeping warm its egg is kind of nice. So you sit there, just sit really close, have your little egg of virtue close by and keep it warm. And sometimes people forget to keep their ethical sensibilities warm and, you know, cooking, growing. So the word I keep using, the expression I keep using is ethical sensibility, sensitivity. Because the assumption in Buddhism is that if we develop a sensitivity, a presence, a mindfulness, a clear awareness, an open awareness to ourselves and to others, that it's going to be very hard to be unethical. It's somehow innate in the human being to be ethical. And so part of the part of what we do in Buddhism is not so much focus on moral codes and commandments, this is how you should behave, but rather we rely on somehow cultivating and developing the depth of sensitivity that is available to us, that's possible, and then let our ethical life come out of that sensitivity and not out of some rule and codes. There are precepts in Buddhism. There are ethical codes in Buddhism, but they're not meant as commandments. They're meant as supports and aids to developing this deeper sensitivity. And one of the arguments, one of the teachings around the five precepts, for example, the five basic moral codes that lay Buddhists will follow, is that these are descriptions of how a person would live if they're coming from their deep ethical sensitivity, their deep kind of Buddha nature, their kind of good heart. A person coming out of their good heart and who really, really is stabilized there and is not going to sacrifice it for anything, is incapable of killing, incapable of stealing, incapable of lying, incapable of harming people through their sexuality, at least intentionally. And they say incapable of intoxicating themselves with alcohol or drugs. And so part of the function of these precepts is to offer us a guideline saying, when you're about to break this, cross this line, and you're about to kill or steal or lie, wake up. This is probably an indication that you've lost touch with something really precious and important inside yourself. Use that possibility of breaking a precept or having broken one. Use that as a mirror to focus back on yourself and see if you can get back in touch with your own beauty, with your own sensitivity. So rather than using it as a guilt trip or as an obligation, it's to come back to that place where it becomes natural to want to be ethical again. Now, people who practice meditation, mindfulness practice, often report that after months and years of practice, their ethical sensitivity develops on its own. And then it becomes, makes more and more sense that they want to protect this and save it. And it makes more sense than to use the precepts as signposts pointing us back to that purity or the beauty inside of us. Another way of using the precepts in Buddhism is, it's kind of connected to this, is as ways of helping to understand ourselves better. So not just simply understanding where our ethical beauty is, but understand all the things that get in the way. The impulses, the arguments in the mind of why we should do this, all the different forces that move us away from some deep heartfelt connection to others. So to understand our fear, to understand our ambition, our hate, our greed, to understand what's going on there. And a very important part of, you know, of Buddhist practice or mindfulness practice involves a self-understanding. If we don't really understand ourselves well, then I think any kind of moral code becomes a danger. So the emphasis always is, how do we understand ourselves better and come back to here? The ethics or virtue in Buddhism is not something to be believed in, but rather something to care about, to be concerned about, to explore and develop and refine. One of the interesting explorations in all this is for what would you sacrifice your ethical purity? If you have some sense that, you know, some degree of kind of ethical standards or values that come out of your heart, what are you willing to sacrifice it for? When are you willing to lie? For what? When are you willing to, you know, to steal? In what circumstance? Probably, I suspect probably most of you would not be willing to steal big time, but maybe there's small things you're willing to steal for. Oh, that doesn't matter, you know, I'll just do this. You know, what are you willing to sacrifice, you know, or overlook or belittle the ethical sensitivity that you have? And I think everybody has probably, most people, unless you're fully enlightened, have some place where it becomes kind of shaky. Well, you know, maybe I'll look at this and maybe in this situation, you know, I'm willing to lie, you know. But what's interesting is that I find is that you find in human beings a range of commitment to their own ethical purity. And there are some people who you meet who, for example, have such a commitment to truth, to being honest, that almost nothing will cause them to violate their dedication to being honest and truthful. It just kind of and you see that sometimes it develops very early in life. Maybe there are people, some people are born that way, some children, they just, you know, they're going to be honest. They're just kind of they feel so violated. They violate themselves if they're going to try to say a lie. But they just simply can't do it. Spiritual practice is meant to kind of enhance our ethical sensitivity so that there's less that we're willing to sacrifice for it. Because when we sacrifice it, we're sacrificing something which deep inside of us is something really beautiful. And as the quote said, it's a form of wealth that no one can take away from us. It's a source of security and safety, which you carry with you even when you go to jail, even when you go to all kinds of situations where that we normally would think, you know, is not so safe. Now the perfection of virtue, the virtue when it's a parami, one of these qualities, there are, there are two guidelines or supports or motivations for living an ethically pure life as a perfection. One is its connection to compassion, and the other is its connection to liberation. And these work very well together. When our motivation to be ethical is based on compassion and liberation together, the two support, balance, and correct each other from being imbalanced. So compassion then becomes very important. And how is my behavior compassionate? How does it alleviate suffering? How does it respond to the suffering? And how does it help? How does it cause less suffering? And this is where the concern for others becomes very important in Buddhism. That our own ethical depth, our own depth of sensitivity to ourselves is connected to our ability to be compassionate, to cultivate compassion. And out of the compassion then becomes the guideline for making ethical decisions more than a fixed rules. And compassion is not always so black and white. What is a compassion response in different situations? Some people would say that it's kind of depends on the situation. In different situations, the opposite response would be the compassionate, appropriate response. So when Buddhists look at what is it that is the ethical thing to do, they're often falling back and asking instead, what's the compassionate thing to do here? And that's, okay. And the second thing is the connection to liberation. How does this behavior that I'm about to do, how does my actions, my motivations, my thoughts, how are they connected to liberation, to becoming free, to becoming expansive, to having the heart or the mind relaxed, at ease, uncontracted, spacious? How does it help that? And so then the question is, looking at our behavior, looking at our intentions, what is it that moves us in that direction? What is it that supports that? If we're looking at only at compassion, we might somehow not take care of ourselves well enough and end up becoming contracted. If we only focus on ourselves and our own liberation, then I don't think compassion can really do its job very well. You need to have both working together. So ethics in Buddhism is something which is connected to the depth of our hearts, something connected to the core values of the tradition, compassion and liberation. And ethics is something that is the foundation for being able to go deep into the Buddhist spiritual life. So, those are my thoughts for today. We have 10 minutes, and now I hope that you'll have some interesting questions or some interesting comments. What would you like to say? For those of you, this might be relevant. What are your thoughts? Yes, please.
I received a traffic ticket in Oregon. It was a speed trap, basically. When I got home, I couldn't read the ticket. It either said $37 or $237. And I'm supposed to respond to this by tomorrow. What is the ethical way to handle this?
Well, someone said a phone call. I mean, I think the right thing to do is try to find out more information. Try to find out.
There's no phone number given. Although I imagine I could call information.
Yeah. Well, look on the web. Maybe the county has a list of traffic violation costs. You know, on the website. You know, so I would try to find out. That's what I would do. And sometimes the ethical thing to do is to get more information. Learn more. Laziness is an obstacle to our ethical purity. And not a comment about you. I just remembered.
All right.
Well, that's a huge topic. There is this idea that the people who have claimed the big raft for themselves, they're the ones who say the others have the small raft. This big raft is one that can carry a lot of people, ferry a lot of people across to safety, to liberation. And a small raft is so small that you can only get you across. That's what the big people say. The people who claim our raft is bigger than your raft. And I think that mostly the people who have the so-called big raft have never had any contact with the people who have the small, so-called small raft. So there's kind of like a straw man. So historically in Buddhism, when the Mahayana was criticizing the earlier traditions, the so-called Hinayana, they were mostly criticizing a straw man, somebody they didn't actually know. And actually, the further apart historically they became, the more vehement the criticism was. So much so that when I was in Japan, practicing with a Zen teacher there, practiced there for a while, and then I went to Thailand and practiced for a while. And Thailand belongs to the small raft school, kind of. I mean, that's what we're told. Then I went back to Japan and told my teacher I'd been practicing in Thailand, and he said, you've been practicing with the devil. And he'd never been to Thailand, he had no contact with that tradition. So, you know, people like to kind of, you know, use the other as a way of helping to find themselves. And so Buddhists have done that down through the ages. So it's a huge topic, and I kind of wrote my dissertation on this topic, so I, you know.
Well, it seems like both were needed, the way you were saying, like you need both.
But both are needed. And the early tradition would not agree with the criticism that their raft is self-centered. But there is a little bit more emphasis on, there's some truth to it, but it's overdone. And so this kind of teaching about the connection between of compassion and liberation, and working together, is pretty central to the Theravadin tradition. You see, it's a little bit hard, this discussion, because in early Buddhism, in a kind of way, they didn't have the same sharp dichotomy between self and other that this raft analogy depends on. And so it was kind of understood that we benefit ourselves, we're also benefiting others. If we're benefiting others, we're also benefiting ourselves. And so there's no hard and fast distinction between it. And there's something where, you know, if someone wants to become a doctor and help a lot of people, they, in a sense, can look like from outside for 7 years or 14 years, or I don't know, 70 years, I don't know how long it takes to get trained as a doctor in America, a long time. They have to be very selfish. You can kind of say they're kind of, not always, but they're kind of focusing and studying and taking their exams and a lot of, it's a very, very intense kind of thing. And then once they get their medical degree, then they can go out and they can help a lot of people. You know, most people. I mean, don't push the analogy, just kind of, just go along with me. So in the early Buddhist tradition, they have this idea that if two people are stuck in quicksand, they can't help each other out. One will, you know, if one pulls the other one, the one pulling is going to sink down further. So one person has to get up on the dry land, and then they can pull the other one out. So there's some sense that it's really important for each individual to practice as deeply as they can, because then they can be more helpful to others. But the motivation for practicing is partly out of compassion, so you can be more helpful to others. So this is a huge topic, and you know, it's an interesting one, but maybe another time. Yes.
You made a comment, if I remember correctly, something about for people who don't know themselves very well, ethics is a problem, or it's a danger or something. And so I was hoping for a little more comments along that line.
I don't remember what I was said exactly, but if a person doesn't know themselves very well, was it near the end or in the beginning of the talk?
In the middle.
If a person doesn't know themselves very well, then when they're following ethical rules, for example, then they don't really know what's motivating them, and they can use them in horrible ways. You know, they can be filled with hate, and they're using an ethical standard to beat people over the head with, or something. That's one thing they can do. So you have to understand what's going on inside of you. Also, if a person doesn't know themselves very well, then they don't have very deep sensitivities or resources inside of themselves in order to be able to understand the situation around them. You can't really understand a situation outside of us, I think, so ethical situation, without really understanding ourselves well also. Or to say it differently, I believe to really understand a situation and us in that situation, we have to have a very deep sensitivity to all the intuitions, all the sources of understanding that exist within us. And if a person doesn't know themselves very well, it's synonymous with not being so sensitive, not having those intuitions or those intelligences operating. Yes, please.
I'm in a situation right now where I'm having an ethical dilemma, so to speak. I'm a private piano teacher who was invited to teach at a school. And so for 3 weeks, everything was going along smoothly. There's another teacher that teaches group lessons in the school. I was told at the very beginning that was okay. This person did the group, I do the private lessons. When this person found out that I was there, that I was doing this, now granted she had been there for 6 years and had never offered private lessons. Okay. So when she saw that I was there, my flyer was up, she went into orbit, so to speak, and is absolutely, she wants me out of there. Okay. And her reasoning behind that is the fact that she feels that I'm stealing students from what could be her group, her program. And I have an advocate in this. This is the boss who's in charge of this program, said no. Jennifer was hired, that's me, to be the private teacher. You are this. Well, to make a long story short, this has been going on now for a month, where this person has gone behind this other person's back to try to get students. They have continued to stir up trouble. Okay. My dilemma is, on the one hand, I feel for this person that she was there first. Yes, I am. The students that I am taking came to me with the understanding that I was the private person. But this person is just hysterical that I'm there. So my ethical dilemma is, on the one hand, I feel like, I don't know. I mean, I think it speaks for itself. I think it speaks for itself. So it's part of me feels like I should just back out of the situation and let it be, let her have, okay? The other part feels like, no, I didn't do anything wrong. I was asked by parents that highly recommended me to go into that situation. I already have developed relationships with these kids and parents and everybody, and they want me to continue to teach.
Mm-hmm. So yes, sounds tricky. So a few things I could say. It's a huge issue, I suppose, to explore, and I would usually take something like that and look at a number of different responses, not just one way of responding, but look at different areas of simultaneously to respond. But I think one of the first things I think in Buddhist practice, what a person would do, would to look at themselves, like you would look at yourself, and see what needs to be liberated inside of you. Is there fear in you? Is there anger in you? Is there, you know, what are some of the things? Are you feel hurt? What are some of the, you don't have to answer now, but what are some of the things going inside of you that makes this a distressing situation for you?
I feel guilty.
Yeah, you don't have to explain. So whatever. So whatever's going on. Yeah, but we don't have a lot of time. We're supposed to end. That's why I want to just. But the first thing is really look and see is there anything extra, any kind of contraction that you have that you can liberate, that you can free. Now, some Buddhists will only do that part and never step into the conflict and work with it directly. Just, oh, it's all about me, I have to find somebody to let go and just be peace. And that's not very healthy just to only do it that way. But it's a very good as a first beginning. Because then if you can get settled and get liberated yourself and kind of liberate yourself from whatever's distressing you in it in some kind of unnecessary way, then there's a greater clarity in all directions to understand what to do next. And then when we do go into the conflict, we're less likely to be reactive in the situation. And some people neglect that personal part. They jump into the conflict or they run away without first settling themselves in the situation. And so for people meditating is a really helpful way of doing that. The second thing has to do with compassion. And that is, you know, what is the compassionate thing here? And you seem to express some compassion and concern for her. And so you have to take her situation into account. And that is both what could be considered reasonable and unreasonable. Sometimes when people are totally unreasonable in their demands and the way they see a situation, sometimes when you realize they're incapable of seeing it any other way, and they're so hurting so much inside, sometimes we'll just bend over for them, or, okay, you do it, you know. And sometimes that's the wrong thing to do. Sometimes we have to make strong boundaries. And I don't know this person. I haven't met this person, so I don't know. The fact that you were invited into the school to teach, it wasn't exactly your choice. And said you were invited. In some sense, it's not exactly your responsibility. It's for you to go to your supervisor and say, you know, this is unacceptable for me to continue here in this situation. And something has to happen here. And you might offer to meet with a person in mediation. So maybe the three of us can meet with her, and maybe we can have a kind of, you know. And I'm a great believer in conflict, whenever possible, for everyone involved to talk together. But hopefully only after they've had a chance to settle themselves. At least one party, one person. So as we leave now and end now, I don't know if I've managed to convey this at all today, but what I'd like to for you to leave with is the idea that the ethical core, ethical sensitivity, the ethical virtue that within our hearts is something that can bring us a lot of joy and delight and happiness, and something that offers a very, very deep and abiding satisfaction and value to our lives. And not something to be kind of dismissive of or overlook and think it's kind of heavy and somber, but rather it's something that really is, brings delight and peace. So may you all reflect on this wonderful perfection of virtue over the next month. Thank you.